Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Jonathan Gratis, the Executive Director of the New York State Defenders Association, NYSDA, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving the quality and scope of public legal representation in New York. The association operates the nation's first state-funded public defense backup center, which serves New York's more than 6,000 public defense attorneys, providing training, legal research, consultation, and technical assistance. In addition, NYSDA has a duty to review, assess, and analyze the public defense system in the state, identify problem areas, and propose solutions in the form of specific recommendations to the governor, the legislature, and the judiciary, and other appropriate instrumentalities. Mr. Gratis is also executive director of the New York State Defenders Justice Fund. Jonathan Gratis began his career as a paralegal, thereafter graduating cum laude in 1973 from Hofstra Law School's charter class. He has worked as a criminal defense lawyer, a private investigator, and a law school professor. Mr. Gratis is the recipient of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association's 2016 Reginald Herbert Smith Award, the New York Not-for-Profit Media's Cause Awards, 2016 Overall Sector Support, the Capital Punishment Committee of the City of New York Bar Association's 2016 Norman J. Redlick Award for Capital Defense Distinguished Service, the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Regional Chapter's 2016 Carol S. Knox Award, the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Gideon Award, and the New York State Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section Award for Outstanding Contribution to the Delivery of Defense Services. Jonathan Gratis serves on the Restorative Justice Commission of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Albany and the Board of Directors of Equal Justice USA and New Yorkers for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. We'll talk with Jonathan Gratis about all of this and much more, but first, on a personal level, I've known him for 1,000 years. Welcome, Jonathan Gratis.
Why, thank you, Alan. Good to be here.
I guess the first question is, how did you get started? I like these conversations to sort of explore who people are. Where were you born?
I was born in New York City. I was born in Manhattan, lived in Queens, and then moved quite a bit to a number of different towns. And
was it with your parents, or did you get raised in Manhattan?
No, I was with my parents, yeah.
So when you say Queens and other places, you all went together?
We all did for a while. Then my parents actually got divorced when I was about 10 years old, and most of the rest of the moves with my mother or by myself.
Yeah. And is there anything in your history that you can look back and say, you know, something made you want to be on the side of the oppressed?
Well, I think I came from a very highly developed, spiritually developed family that believed in doing good works. My grandmother and met her husband essentially pulling drunks off the Bowery, and my family has always been involved in charitable kind of civil rights activities. So I was naturally raised in it, you know, and then at the height of the Vietnam War, one sort of could not function without making a choice about how to be in the world, and I think one thing led to another. I know it's really, it was the Vietnam War that led me to the law, because I thought I would be prosecuted for resisting going, and, you know, here you are.
Did you go to college?
I went to college in Galesburg, Illinois at Knox College.
At Knox College. And then you became a paralegal, then you became a lawyer. Take us through that course.
Well, I graduated from college in 1969. And after deciding I was too frightened to go to prison for draft resistance, I filed a conscientious objector application, a lengthy one, 125 pages. And I figured, they will certainly accept me.
Did you have a lawyer to help you do this?
No. And they did not accept me, but by that time I had gone to the New York City Legal Aid Society and applied for a job and was hired almost on the spot as one of their first paralegals, with the consequence that, you know, I was exposed to the criminal justice system in 1969 in New York City, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. You know, people had calendars with hundreds and hundreds of cases and very little resources. Sometimes they didn't have law books. Sometimes they didn't have time to even see their clients. A lot of pleas. There was a strike that was had in 1970 that was led by Jerry Lefcourt, who he had been with the Chicago 7 trial, really the Chicago 8 trial, started a union, had been fired, was at that moment I was hired suing the Legal Aid Society. But the first strike in May of 1970, everyone went out, and by that time I had been convinced that there could be reform for the public defense system through unionization, even though initially I had been opposed to the idea. But I wasn't in the union, so I was immediately fired for going out in solidarity. And at the end of that year, I went to apply for a job in Brockport, University of Brockport, teaching American government and continuing my paralegal work for a legal services office in Monroe County. And after having gotten both those jobs, I was lying in a motel room and decided I was going to go to law school. And I decided, it's a little late in the month of August, I think, but Hofstra was had just started, and I was able to get into Hofstra and graduate in the charter class.
Right. So was law school challenging? Did you learn what you needed to learn, or was it just one more ticket that you needed to pick up?
Well, I think I learned what I needed to learn, and it was one more ticket to pick up. A ticket only in the sense that I needed to pass the bar. I wanted to come back and work at Legal Aid. I only applied for one job. I mean, I was on the initial board of the Law Review. I probably could have gone to Wall Street, although I'm also the original resigner of the Hofstra Law School Law Review.
Why'd you resign?
Well, you know, there's a million law reviews. Right. They're all the same. They're filled with footnotes. And we had said, look, we're a new law school. We could create a really creative book. It could be, you know, avant-garde. I surveyed people who were in the field at the time. There were 15 editors. And actually, the vote was 8-7. So I came very close to convincing the powers that be that Hofstra Law Review could have been a kind of avant-garde idea. I was labeled as the one calling for a comic book by our faculty advisor, but that's why.
And this tells us something about your character, because obviously if you're on a law review and you're looking for a big job, not in a basically social services law firm, but a Wall Street firm, it's pretty good to be on a law review, and you eschewed that, right?
Well, I did. I had been convinced that there could be much more creative. I don't know if you've read many law reviews, Alan, but they are long.
I spent almost every evening doing that, yeah.
You know, lengthy footnotes, and they're all pretty much the same. And I thought, you know, I had this idea, like, why don't we go around and sort of compare high schools and prisons in New York State?
Sure.
Because they're, you know, sometimes the same square footage and very similar. Or I remember being in touch with Will Hellerstein, who was then the head of appeals in New York City, and other people of his character. And so if you were starting new, what kind of law review would you do? And they all had good ideas, and most of these were rejected because Hofstra had to become, in many ways, the law school that it has become. It's a very good school, but it, you know, it followed the path of traditionalism, as most law schools do.
Yeah. So as we say in my house, then what happened?
Well, I did, in fact, apply for the one job I wanted. I went back to the Legal Aid Society. I worked as a lawyer in the South Bronx.
Well, do they remember when you were a bad boy and, you know, went out on strike?
Yeah, I think they did.
All is forgiven? You can come back now?
I don't know that all was forgiven, but I did come back. I guess there aren't a lot of people only apply for one job. That may have had something to do with convincing them. And I think my loyalty actually to the Legal Aid Society was part of it. Anyway, I then started to practice law, and I found the practice of law in the South Bronx to be condemnable. The same kind of thing I had seen as a paralegal.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I'm behind here. You were still with the Legal Aid Society?
Yeah, I became a lawyer.
You became a lawyer in the Legal Aid Society.
And I worked at the Legal Aid Society.
But did you also have an outside practice?
No.
Okay, I get it.
I was assigned to the Bronx.
Yeah.
But the same kind of thing happened. There were calendars that were too large to be able to investigate cases, calendars that were too large to be able to spend time with your clients. I remember I had worked a lot as a private investigator during law school, and when I first got the Legal Aid...
Did you carry a gun? Or?
No, I don't like guns, actually. Sorry. The first day I got the Legal Aid, I had worked as an investigator and knew somewhat what we ought to do with our cases, and I went to the investigators with my little form that was filled out that said, I want you to go investigate the neighborhood of this complaining witness. Turned out the neighborhood was in Orange County, and they laughed at me. But I wanted a neighborhood check on a complaining witness. It was a welfare administrator who had alleged to have been assaulted by my client on the Grand Concourse. So I told my supervisor that day, well, I won't be here tomorrow because I'm going to Orange County to investigate this case myself because our investigators aren't doing it. So after a series of things like that, I actually left. And I went back to practice in Long Island. For a long time, I was solicited to be on the faculty of Hofstra in their clinical program. And I finally succumbed to that in 1975. And actually, you know as much of the story after 1976 as I do, because it was then that we were tapped for this job, Creating Standards and Goals, by Jim Dahl. And I left that office and went to create standards and goals with you.
Now, you and I, we went around the state riding in a bus. I remember that. And that's all I remember. I don't remember anybody else or anything else.
Well, there had been, you know, at the tail end of the Nixon administration, oddly enough, there had been a, well, in 1967, there was a report called the Administration of Justice in New York. It was the President's Commission on the Administration of Justice. And one of their recommendations was that there be a set of standards and goals created for the justice system. And so the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration was created, and every state had to go through a process of creating standards and goals for their police, for corrections, for defense. And New York was the last state to go through this process. And I left, you know, my job thinking, well, I'm going to the state. They're serious about this. This will be a way to get money to the defense function. And it took about 4 months before I realized that, you know, it was a kind of a jokey process. But what we did was to create those standards and submit them to the Crime Control Planning Board. Of course, you were a contemporary of Bert Nagata. Bert was the chairperson of the Task Force on Prosecution and Defense. And we created a structure such that even after the grant ended, that task force had to go on. It went on for about a year and a half. It was the bane of the existence of the commissioner of DCJS. But it created a number of good things. And one of those things was a study of defense services throughout the state. And that's how I came to know about the problems of all this state.
Well, but here's the problem for so many people who get involved in the system, who become public defenders. And that is, at some point, they've got to wake up in the morning and realize that the system is so loaded and so unfair that they can't possibly be doing a good job.
Well, I think you've put your finger on exactly why this moment in New York is so critical, because there has been a period beginning at the end of the last century, if I may say, 1999, to the present, in which a number of efforts to improve public defense services in New York have taken place. We've been responsible for some of them. Two chief judges have been responsible for others. There have been an effort to raise assigned counsel fees, an effort to create standards for public defenders, to raise all the boats. And finally, after Judge Kaye created a commission in 2006 calling for the state takeover of public defense services and the state administration of defense services by the creation of an independent public defense commission, I think you'll recall I was on the show, a call-in show with David Patterson. He was on the show saying, hey, what do you think of this idea? And he liked it. We found ourselves in New York in 2007 with a lawsuit filed by the New York Civil Liberties Union on behalf of plaintiffs in five counties declaring the system unconstitutional. And that lawsuit was pending for 7 years, was settled in 2014-15, and it resulted in five counties receiving state resources at a much greater level than they would have received by the county funding mechanism that was started in the Rockefeller administration. And what happened was, as they received money for paying for counsel at first appearance, and they received money to improve quality generally, they received money to cap caseloads, they received money to implement new eligibility standards, 57 other counties in the state said, hey, what are we, chopped liver? And that built a rather large momentum for people calling on the state to fix the whole state at once, a global solution, if you will. And that resulted in a bill which passed the legislature last June, 187-0, 62-0 in the Senate, and 125-0 in the Assembly. And that bill will shortly be on its way to Governor Cuomo. And it is our great hope that he's going to sign it. And what it does, it makes the first step in this right direction. It calls on the state over a period of 7 years to take over the financing of public defense services at the local level in a reimbursement program. And that bill would, in fact, eventually drive quality in New York. And I think it will. It also places the Indigent Legal Services Office in the center of a process on behalf of the state to improve the quality of public defense representation, to make rules and regs and create standards and to help counties. And it's been doing that for 5 years already, 6 years already. But this would empower them in a new way. And I think we're at a real watershed. And we're waiting for the governor to sign it. It hasn't gone up to him yet, but there's no group that I'm aware of that's opposing it. It's supported by the State Association of Counties, the Civil Liberties Union, defenders across the state, county officials across the state, 200 leaders in New York. The NAACP just filed a gigantic letter with the governor. The ABA president has written. It's sort of everybody's on board this thing, and I'm hoping that the governor will find his way to signing it. I have, on a number of occasions over the last 7 years, urged him to find a way towards a global solution where the state could be in control of the process of doing it incrementally. This bill is a very real way, a gift to him, because it statutorily would do just that.
And it's politically a gift to him because he's got trouble on his left right now.
Yeah, it would be a political gift. I mean, I was saying, I actually had a conversation with this council last week, and I do think they're very seriously looking at this. And one of the things I said was, you know, I think this is morally imperative. It's politically, conceptually good. There's not much, you know, as much as he cares about Black Lives Matter, there's not much he can do to fix police in New York City. He's done some things on reducing mass incarceration at the level of minimum, you know, not maxi level prisons. But this is something that with a single signature on a bill, he can really say, I'm Andrew Cuomo. I'm standing next to clients in this state. I'm a governor who will recognize the way forward through this thicket. I'm going to stand with people of color. They're going to have now on my watch advocates beside them who are not overburdened by cases, who can investigate their cases, who can articulate a basis for releasing people at arraignment, who can be at arraignment. And I think it is a wonderful gift to him.
You just mentioned police. I'm interested in that. You know, I know you're a straight talker, but is there a big police problem when it comes to defendants in New York State?
Sure there is.
Tell me about it.
Not just New York State, but all states. Well, you know,
America has
done a very big disservice to the police of this country. You know, they have become, quite frankly, the shock troops of American society. And given a blank check that if they can keep people safe in their homes, they can get away with all kinds of things. And frankly, there's a relationship between this issue of them getting away with things and the impoverishment of the public defense system, because police officers know very well that if they cut corners, or worse, commit perjury, or finger a guy who may have done something else if he didn't do this crime, or do any one of the kinds of things that we do find, hide the ball on evidence that might exculpate someone, they know that they're not going to be challenged. You know, you can't be sitting handling 1,000 cases a year, or the average in New York is 700 cases a year.
Per lawyer.
Right.
Lawyer, yeah.
You can't expect that people are going to dig in and investigate cases with the robust level of representation that is required. There are lawyers who do it. There are offices that do it. I'm not saying there aren't. But the reality is that in the vast majority of cases, it's an impossibility. Lawyers for the rich or for people of means are asked to do several things with their clients. They're asked to meet them, build rapport with them, talk to their families, go out and investigate facts, look at the law, apply the law to the facts, make motions, do subpoena practice, maybe do more after you foil information and build a plan for defense or strategize for an alternative disposition that favors the liberty interests of the client. Well, that's all fine and good, but you can't do it in 59 minutes a case. And in many places in this state, that's the amount that you've got.
So I remember taking, I taught a course long, long time ago. I don't know if you were part of it, but it was called Law Society and the Legal Profession at New Paltz. It was a 15-credit course, and we were in the field all the time. Mm-hmm. And I took them to the Supreme Court of the United States, and Justice Douglas talked to us and went to all of these other places. But I remember one day, we were down in the criminal courts. I don't know if it was Jerry Lefcourt or somebody took us in there, and there was a plea bargain, and we were allowed by both sides to come in and see the plea bargain, which lasted about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit
A lengthy plea bargain.
Yes, and I may be wrong about that. It may have been less. And there was a little bit of back and forth. Okay, give him a nickel, meaning 5 years or something like that, or no, I insist on a single tenor. And it went back and forth for, as I say, for about 5 minutes, and boom, the whole thing, this guy's life was decided. So let's talk about plea bargains.
Well, let's talk about those lives first. I was asked to give a Law Day speech last year, and I went to a bar association in upstate New York, and I said, please indulge me. I know you're all lawyers, and this is a bar association, but I want you, if you would, imagine for a minute that you're a client, and imagine that you're being arrested, and imagine, even if you will, that you had nothing to do with the events. And imagine yourself being thrown in the back of a squad car, and what that door sounds like and what it feels like on your way to the little justice court in your town where you're hopeful finally that you'll have a lawyer standing next to you, but you don't have a lawyer standing next to you. You have an arraignment with a farmer sitting on the bench with no stenographer who is sending you to jail. And by this time, think, if you will, put your hands on your stomach, how large does it feel like to have that basketball feeling in your stomach? Because that's what you'll have at this point. And you're now approaching the jail, and the door clangs behind you, and smells that you've never smelled and sounds that you've never had are affecting you. That's what I want to talk to you about tonight when I talk to you about client-centered representation and fighting for a just new system. And I was very happy the governor's public safety, one of his public safety directors was at that speech. I'm hoping that it had an impact. But the reality is that the plea bargaining process is a function of many things. You know, on its own, if people fully investigate the facts of a case and decide this person is going to be guilty, not of a robbery second, but could be found guilty of a robbery third, and you investigate the facts and you interview your client and you actually find out that that's what the real consequence of the activity that took place is, and you try for alternative dispositions, but you don't get it, but you get a plea to an attempted robbery third, that is, in fact, arguably a success. And that success is very hard to explain to people because surrounding their coming to that event are often efforts to call their lawyer who can't find the time to respond, or efforts to be seen in jail who can't, or where lawyers don't have the time to come, or being held on $150 bail, which you cannot make, and thereby losing your apartment, and your dog is actually stolen from your apartment because you're not there. And those kinds of things mean that the first step in the punishment is all before you take that. Sometimes a plea is the first step in relieving the punishment. That's actually how bad the system is. The system is bad in many, many respects. Plea bargaining sometimes is a relief. You mentioned New York City. New York City would collapse if it didn't have a system of pleading people guilty at arraignment. 85,000 people in 2014 pled guilty at arraignment. Now, what does that mean? That means that people walked in the front door of the courthouse and walked out the front door of the courthouse, having met their lawyer for the first time, having had their entire client-attorney relationship, having been exposed to the criminal justice system, and having disposed of their case by a plea of guilty. You don't build up respect for a justice system that is run like that. I mean, 85,000 people, to give you a sense, that's like 20,000 more people than are tried in all of Kentucky, right? That's a lot of people. And if you are like me, you know, 69 years old, I know I can't hold a candle to you, Alan.
No, you can't.
But we're on a third generation of clients, people whose fathers and grandfathers were involved in one form or another knowing the criminal justice system, maybe not as defendants, but everybody in the client community has the experience of having someone who was either falsely accused or poorly represented or served hard time for something they shouldn't do. And you can't build respect for a justice system unless you really start and build respect for justice system, which is why we're urging the governor to take this step on signing this bill. This is a bill that can really bring change in New York.
So as the old saying goes, two steps forward, three steps back. Donald Trump has just been elected president of the United States. And where Barack Obama started talking about prison people, too many people of color in prisons, this is the way he wanted to spend most of his time after he gets to be president, working on that problem. Now Trump comes along, and I think he's anything but Barack Obama. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, Alan, I've been at this rodeo before, not quite with this scope and not quite with this rhetoric, but I was bemused, if you will, that Trump attached himself to Newt Gingrich. You remember 1994, we faced this exact same thing here, the contract on America. We ended up with George Pataki, who came in, and, you know, for my office, that was a pretty serious thing. We were defunded for 9 years.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, but as I look at it, you know, he got 0 to 1% in this election, you know, and we're still here. And that's what's going to happen after Trump. I did get this Reginald Haber Smith away. I don't know how you got all that stuff, but I gave a talk to about 1,000 people at the National Legal Aid and Defender Association convention. Maybe it was less, but it was a pretty big full room. And I said, really, remember Ronald Reagan. Remember, he came in and he said he would destroy the Legal Services Corporation. And he said, there's waste there and there's fraud there. And, you know, all of us were walking around the NLADA convention that year and saying, are you waste or are you fraud? You know, but the Legal Services Corporation just put in a budget request for $486.9 billion, right? So these institutions of America are stronger than Trump appreciates. They're stronger than the people around him appreciate. You know, you can go in and you can change that Justice Department, maybe put a Rudy Giuliani in it, but there's 630 people who are not going anywhere in that Justice Department, who are in the midst of litigation, who've been carrying out policies that are in the Civil Rights Act since 1965. You're just not going to turn a battleship around in a lake. And so I think it's a terrible thing that the rhetoric that has poisoned America is having the impact on loosening the devils of racism in a new way. But I also think at the same time there's something very valuable about that. In this sense, racism has been the engine that has driven the criminal justice system for as long as I have been a part of it. It has been an aspect every single day. There has been racism on the bench. There have been racism in prosecutors. There have been racism in defense lawyers. There have been racism in cops. There's been implicit bias. There's been explicit bias. It is the engine that drives the system. And if you need any further evidence, read today's Times on the beatings of prisoners at Midstate. So what I think Trump has done in a very strange way, what this campaign has done, it's drawn things out almost like we put a leech on America. And it is drawing forward in a much louder, more robust way that which I've seen my whole life, that which I've fought against my whole life, that which other poverty lawyers have been embedded in. And, you know, in the same way that the Contract on America failed and Newt Gingrich failed the first time and Pataki and Vacco failed, I think Trump will fail. I think America is bigger and greater. I also think that when you look at, you know, the white rural vote that propelled him, they have legitimate grievances that America has ignored. White rural poor people have been the subject of tremendous dislocation and abuse. And maybe this will have an impact on the Democratic Party and other parties to recognize that we are one nation and we need to fix ourselves. So while I am, you know, reeling 7 days after, I must tell you also, I exercise every morning and I watch movies. I chose 7 Days in May as the movie for this week. Worth re-seeing.
They play it on the old movie channel quite a bit, and I've watched it a couple of times. It's a great movie.
But I think we'll survive this thing.
Okay, so Jonathan Gratis, I guess the question then is about race. You mentioned it, we passed over it, but race has to fit into some kind of paradigm about America. You know, you had slavery, you had Jim Crow. Is the fact that our prisons are so overwhelmingly filled with people of color, is that just part of a process that has been ongoing in this country all along?
I think so. I think it is. And I think very much, you know, in the same way that I said the police are abused by the choices we make for them, I am, despite the small cadre of people who do brutalize inmates, and maybe not so small, but it comes in a way with the territory, I also think the way we will liberate prisoners from prisons is by liberating the guards with them. The truth is that guards have a terrible, terrible job. We call on them to do terrible, terrible work. There's no excuse for putting people who are born free into the kind of alien environment that we call our prisons, in which the last thing that they can be is vulnerable. The last thing they can show are their emotions, that they have to hide in their cell if they want to cry over the loss of a loved one, that we give them 16 cents an hour and don't teach them anything about organizing, don't teach them anything about accountability. And then when they come out, we expect them to automatically jump into a world of work which they're perfectly ready for, and they're not ready for it. And the guards, on the other hand, they all walk on cement. It's really bad for guards' feet. You don't hear a lot of that over here at the Capitol, but it is very bad. And their suicide rate is very high, and their blood pressure is through the roof. And they commit acts of domestic violence and desperation, and they drink themselves to early deaths. And suicide rate is higher than any other law enforcement agency. You can't keep institutions like that for either the prisoners or the guards and expect to have a healthy society. The Dutch, there was an article in the paper this week about Dutch prisons. They're running out of people to fill them. Right? We need to run out of people to fill them, because most of the people who are in, and I have these debates in public. I'll say you can have 10% of those people, you can keep them in prison, right? The other, 54,000 people, we could find different ways about it. And we've created that. Our good guys, right? We created this term, alternatives to incarceration. Should have never created that term, because what it reflects and what is wrong with America, really, is we have a presumption of incarceration. And you've heard it your whole life. You heard it in elementary school. You do something wrong, you have to pay for it. You spill your milk, you're going to be consequences. You break the law, you got to do the time. And we have a system that is built on that, whereas what we ought to have is something much more like indigenous people who recognize you can't shame people into this. They're going to come back someday. And so what you want are systems that incorporate people, reincorporate them into the society. And that's what we need. And we're moving, frankly, slowly towards that with restorative justice and restorative practices.
And what is restorative justice again?
It's the idea that you rebuild the relationships that have been torn asunder by events of harm. And what it means in practice is that you look at the person who's been harmed and the person who's created harm. And in the context of the community from which they come. You try to build a forward-looking approach to how to prevent harm in the future. You know, there's a saying we use, trail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em. That's the American justice system. And it never works. It's like hitting every nail something that you hit with a hammer.
But Jonathan, on some level, it does work. I mean, you go to upstate New York, and you're going to find something called the prison industry. Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex. We're talking about governors who are wringing their hands. They can't find any way to bring any kind of economic development to upstate New York. But the one thing that you got are these prisons, right?
Well, I don't agree with that in two specific ways. I mean, I know that Betty Little would agree with you, Senator Little. She is, as much as said it at hearings, you sold us a pig and a poke. You gave us these prisons, now you want to take them away. But there are other people in other jurisdictions that say, this isn't working for us in the same way. But I think, you know, way back in 1982, back in the Stanley Fink days, there was an infrastructure task force created in this state. And we were put on it because public buildings were one of the institutions and prisons were a public building. And I took the job very, very seriously. I figured, okay, Stanley Fink has appointed us. And I hired an architect. And this was a very different time and place because we were able to get the plans for six prisons. You can't even get a photograph now, but
yeah.
But we had two minimum, two medium, two maximum prisons. And I hired the architect and I said, I want you to do one thing for us. I want you to come up with an alternative use for these prisons. And I want you to constrain it by the economic impact will be equal to or greater than the prisons that are now there. And he created some really interesting things. He created, for Clinton, I think he created Clinton Correctional Facility, where we had our escape 2 summers ago,
sure,
was going to be a solar factory, which would have been a great advance. And Coxsackie, and I've never been too much of a fan of this, he's going to make it a shopping mall. I don't know which is worse, to tell you the truth. And then it was the year that Volkswagen was competing. We were competing with Ohio to be a Volkswagen plant. And my thought was what the governor should do is OGS should be charged with coming up with an alternative use for every institution immediately. They should have it on the boards. What our governor has done, and I'm very grateful for his first State of the State address where he says we don't build prisons just to have employment. But the truth is, if you fight to get rid of the prison, and only after that you come up with the economic development plan, it's a little backwards. What you need to have is an economic development plan that creates the incentives, and it should incorporate, you know, productive work for the guards and release for the inmates. And Jerry Miller did this in Massachusetts. He closed all the juvenile institutions. You know what he didn't do? He didn't fire the guards. Everybody was happy. I'm not suggesting that that's the approach to take, but I am suggesting that when I did this thing with the infrastructure task force, I sat with NYSCOBA. The union was at the table, and they were fighting at the time for the prison bond issue in those days, wanting more prisons. They still do this. And the truth is, you know, supposing you're the UAW, and you're creating automobiles, and every fifth car, somebody loses a thumb. The union, UAW, does not go out and say, give us another plant, right? They look at the problem. So if I had these workers, thousands of workers, who are suffering terrible heart conditions, terrible blood pressure, having trouble at home, really suffering feet from concrete, I would be part of the movement to make things better. And so I think they all tie together because, you know, Newt Gingrich, this is a funny thing about Trump. Newt Gingrich is now engaged in this whole right on crime group. He's been a voice for changing the criminal justice system. Richard Viguerie, who elected Ronald Reagan, right, who created the moral majority through direct mail, he is in that group. He's anti-death penalty. There's a new group called Conservatives Opposed to the Death Penalty. It's working with all the kind of people that you would at first blush say, oh, those right-wing crazies. Well, they're not right-wing crazies. They're actually further out doing in creative, intelligent things than one would think. So I have a lot of hope. I'm not depressed, but I mean, I'm actually leaving here to go back and have a little lunch with my staff because there's an awful lot of people who are. And I think, you know, I have found myself in the last week.
And they are because of Trump, just to make.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Finding myself really much more closely identified with my clients, with people of color, with Muslims, and going out of my way to really embrace them, to make them feel at home. And maybe that's going to be Trump's gift to us, that all of us will be in greater solidarity with the vulnerable and disenfranchised because we recognize they need us and we will be there for them.
So what's the prognosis? In other words, you've always been a guy who believes we can make changes, and to some degree you've gotten somewhere with that. But can we really expect that prisons are going to close down and be made into Volkswagen plants, or will it be the same old forever? And I'm thinking that with Trump's election, the chances of a federal impetus to make any of these changes is going to be lessened by a lot.
Well, duration is the real issue here. Whether we're swinging in the direction of real reform on the long term, these short-term hits that come when a Ronald Reagan comes into office and claims he'll do one thing, or we have the Immigration Reform Act of 1996, which was Clintonian's period, or AEDPA, which would change habeas corpus. You know, the first thing that the capital litigators in America did after AEDPA is they convened together in the summer and they figured out a strategy to tie up the courts and to use AEDPA to the advantage of clients. That was 1996. We now have less people on death row, less death sentences every year, more states that have come online opposing it. America is actually a good country. It actually is a good country. When you see a crisis in another country, you know, it's not reported as well as it should be. But, you know, there's people who, they get trucks full of water. They say, I'll get a plane. I'll fly this to that place. They give money. The amount of money that flies in from Americans for crises is inordinate. It's unbelievable. There are instincts that go deeper than Trump will ever be able to penetrate. There are going to be hard times in the next 4 years, you bet, or the next 2 years. Possibly in 2 years, we're going to have the biggest change in Congress. I'm telling you, you're a political scientist. I don't know if I'm right or wrong. But this mid-year election will be, I suspect, as different from other mid-year elections as this election was to other elections.
Could be either way.
Yep. And so I just think you got to keep on trucking. I remember Millard Farmer, a great criminal defense lawyer, after we lost the Supreme Court in 1987, McCleskey versus Kemp, which was the challenge to racial discrimination in the death penalty, we lost it. The Atlanta Constitution saw Millard Farmer the next day and came up to him and said, "So, Mr. Farmer, what are you going to do now?" And he drew himself up as Millard would do, and he said, "Well, I guess I'm going to pick up my bucket and move on to the next cow." And I think that's what we're going to do.
You don't have much choice if you want to keep doing what you're doing.
Right.
Do you ever think about retiring?
Actually, I'm going to retire. I'm going to retire next August.
Why? Doesn't seem right.
Well, I will have been in this job for 39 years. Mm-hmm. It's a corporate entity that will be 50 years old at the time. It'll benefit from new and younger leadership. I have some things to do, like maybe after 36 years of marriage, see my wife. That would be good. But I'm actually thinking of doing a number of things. I mean, I might end up with a YouTube channel. I'm going to write. I've got a book of poetry that should have been published 5 years ago that I haven't gotten around to. And I want to open up an art studio in my basement. I mean, I don't think I'll be very far removed from the fray of things. I hope to speak. I hope to get many speaking invitations, also paid. We're going to see. But it is a plan, and I am going to do it.
There is some talk now with the defeat of Hillary Clinton to move you into another sphere. But, you know, attached in a way. And I know, realizing fully that you have a bill before the governor that you desperately want signed, there's increased talk now that Andrew Cuomo will be running for president of the United States in 2020. What do you make of that?
Well, I imagine that that increased talk is a function of the underlying belief that's been around for several years that he wanted to be president. You know, actually, speaking of my bill, I actually think if that is true, as you alluded to earlier, that he needs a left, he needs it even more. And I think that this bill could help him there, too. I believe, well, in my own sense, this is 7 days since it happened, seems like 7 weeks. I think we have a lot of figuring out to do and reconnoitering. And, you know, I know Jeff Klein is down meeting with the Democrats. Finalization.
Listening, Jeff Klein is the head of the Independent Democratic Conference, which has been caucusing with the Republicans. And some people think that Andrew Cuomo was sort of responsible for. And now he's talking to the Democrats about coming back over one way or the other. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, look, I can be as cynical as if I have to be as the next guy. But it is a little hard for me to think of seven people, nominally Democrats, who, if they had the choice to throw their power to Democrats in 2016 or again to Republicans, even with the pressure of the governor, and particularly with the two new members, they may be disinclined to identify with that party at this moment. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of things that are up for grabs around us. And what we need to do is maintain the kind of steady hand on justice that has led this country in the past through very, very dark times.
What if this country goes fascist? In other words,
those fascists or more fascists?
Well, okay, whatever your definition is.
No,
But we were talking now about a country where a Rudy Giuliani might be the head of the Justice Department, maybe not. And this will not be good for your sort of folks, will it?
No, it won't.
And when you face that kind of prospect, how do you hold yourself up?
Well, for lawyers for poor people, we have a present. We can't walk away. What I think this will do in many respects is bring a level of solidarity between client and lawyer that isn't always there. There are going to be, you know, people, there are going to be Muslims who need us and refugees who need us and immigrants who need us and dreamers who need us and criminal defendants who need us. And they will need us more than they ever have. There are going to be communities of color that will fall under attack. They need us more than they ever have. We're going to have to learn some new ways of being and some new ways of acting.
Jonathan, could this be the beginning of the end? That's what I'm worried about. I mean, people talk all the time about, oh, well, nobody really believed that Adolf Hitler in 1929, 1933 was going to turn out to be. They all said, he's a clown. He won't get anywhere. But he did, and we know what the consequences were. What if that scenario happens with Trump?
Well, then I would take a page from Winston Churchill's book, who said at the height of the war, when London is being bombed, when Hitler is on the rampage, he made a speech, he's on the radio, he's talking to the British people, and he says, this is not the end. This isn't even the beginning of the end. This isn't even the end of the beginning. That's what I would say.
Well, that's optimistic.
Well, I mean, look, if it really became fascist and we had goose-stepping in the streets, I don't yet know what I would do. I can remember thinking years ago that this might happen in the 60s. You know, I seriously talked, should we go bury some rifles up at Bear Mountain? We didn't, and I'm not doing it now. And I'm not as convinced that that's a real issue as some might be. I think the structure of the American government, look, if you listen to the chaos today that's going on in the Trump transition team, they can't even organize their team, let alone a new country. I frankly, and I can say it here on WAMC first, I don't think Rudy Giuliani's taking the Justice Department.
No, we probably not.
But, you know, the reality is there.
But there'll always be another Giuliani. I mean,
there'll always be another Giuliani, but there will also be people who surprise these folks. You know, when Earl Warren was appointed to the Supreme Court, he was appointed to the Supreme Court with the thought that he would be a conservative voice on that court. And the entire revolution that has propelled every lawyer my age to do this work and to do it well came from the Warren Court, you know? These kinds of surprises.
Absolutely. But I've always had an alternative theory.
Yeah.
And my alternative theory is Ike knew what he was doing. But when he said later on it was the worst decision that he had ever made to appoint Warren, Warren did exactly what Eisenhower, who was a fair and decent man, wanted.
Well, I hope you're right. That would make the story even better. I mean, I don't think we're in control of the narrative. What I think we're in control of is us and our conscience and what we do and how we resist. And, you know, am I saying that we have to have, like, the French resistance? My gosh, I hope not. I hope not. Because I think, you know, bloodshed is wrong no matter who's drawing it.
One of the things I haven't talked to you about, Jonathan Gratis, today is guns. We have congressmen on all the time. We have the people from Sandy Hook, and we have all the people on who see it. And yet, with the election of Trump, we're going to see more and more and more guns. There's no question in my mind about that. You've been defending people who had guns, others who know about guns. What do you make of guns in the American culture?
Well, you know, I remember talking with Staunton Lind back in 1968, and he said, you know, I want to write some history down because the thought that the South was unarmed, you know, is a misnomer. There were lots of people who were in the nonviolent movement who had shotguns by their door. They had to survive. Black people, you know, and I've been among members of the client community who believed that there will always be oppression from the police and there need to be guns. All that said, I think we should take guns and have them turned into monuments in this central square, find really good welding artists and weld them together into statues and ban the manufacture, sale, and distribution of weapons. I think this nonsense that we hear from, this is probably my appropriation going down the tubes, but this nonsense that we hear from politicians who say the answer is second checks before you buy, I think is such a cop-out. Weapons kill. It is not the case that it's guns kill people. People don't. It's people who kill people. And they do it using guns. They also do it using knives and other weapons. But it's really easier to do with a gun. And I think we've got to get rid of them. I don't think the decision in the Heller case was rightly decided. I don't know how anybody can parse the language of the Second Amendment and come up with this conclusion. I had great hopes that we'd have a court that would come to that conclusion. I don't have those hopes right now, but I think guns are an evil. And I think arming ourselves to kill other people is an evil. And I think that the more we do that, the more death and destruction and violence we shall see.
Well, it's very nice of you, Jonathan Gratis, to say that you believe that we should make these guns into a, melt them down and make them into a giant statue. But that ain't happening. Trump is elected. He's going to make a new Supreme Court. They're going to be with the Heller decision. And, you know, that's just sort of the kind of red meat that you would throw to your troops by saying this is what ought to happen. But how do we get there?
Well, I mean, the truth is that the Heller decision actually has a number of constraints built into it. The court is going to have to deal with those over time. A lot of the people who are most interested in protecting themselves for arrests for gun violations are going to need federal habeas corpus, right? The developments in federal habeas corpus, which have been cut back for the death penalty, may reemerge in the Second Amendment. The country and its legal system are a tremendous mosaic. It's like a balloon. You push it in one place, it pops out another. So, no, I don't think that we're going to... I hope there'll be a day when I get to weld the guns together. I'm not expecting that. That's what I feel about it, because I think there's going to be more guns, more shootings, and more killings. I think America is going to continue to see the level of violence that it has known my entire life. I was born in the shadow of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, a bomb that wasn't necessary to drop, in my opinion. This is a culture that urges death for a solution whenever it can. People believe that they'll get justice. This shooting, I don't know, you know, what happened at the mall, but, you know, there's a story in that shooter. I know that there's a story. And when that story is told, it won't be well heard. We won't use it to change the pattern of how we act. We are not overly bright as a people when it comes to how we distribute justice. It's not a principled system. It's a little more like a psychotic system. So I think there'll be probably increases in weaponry. I think courts will feel constrained to do that. I think the president will continue to talk about it. I think that the people who elected Trump will continue to believe in it. And yet I think in the ultimate march towards civilization, which we're on but not at, eventually weapons as we know them are going to be constrained.
So we don't know whether this was a realigning election in America or not. We do know that Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump did. That, of course, is a good thing if you happen to be a Hillary person or a Democrat or talking the way that you've been talking during this time. And yet, because of an electoral college and because of some of the strategies that were followed, enough people followed Trump so that he won the presidency and maybe setting the agenda, setting the table for a long time in this country. You think maybe not. I think maybe so.
Well, you know, I'm reminded, I gave a speech at Sage College about a month before the election, particularly urging people to remember what had happened in 1968. And one of the things that happened in 1968 is that something like 25% of Bobby Kennedy's voters went over to George Wallace. Leads me to think it's very possible Bernie Sanders could have won this election. Why is that? Because the disaffection of people is so great in the country. I think we have to capitalize on understanding and immersing ourselves in that disaffection and doing something about it. That populist instinct that led to those two candidates is a message to us, and we need to respond to it in positive ways. How is that going to play out? I don't know. Is there going to be damage in the meantime? I think so. Are there sane people probably around Trump who can be reached? I think so to that, too. But, you know, when you look at that split of 62 million here and 62 million there with change in between, you recognize a split right down the center of America. You also recognize that there's like how many other million people didn't come anywhere near the polls, right? I mean, there's a lot of work to be done.
Half the people.
Right.
Yeah, right. So the look to me is not promising. It's not good. It is that our prisons will continue to have overwhelming numbers of black people in them, that there will be some who get a decent lawyer, a decent representation, but there will be many others in this country who do not. And it's got to be frightening for somebody like you.
Well, I think we're on an upward trajectory in two different respects. You know, I find myself, I don't want to say at the end of my career, because I'm not at the end of my career, but I find myself very conscious of the fact that I've spent all of the energies of, you know, since 1978, pushing for an improved public defense system, the truth is that I actually think that we have a kind of a strange legal system which is inching more slowly towards restorative justice. And I think that restorative justice will be the way that we treat one another in the future. The victims community likes it. I think that courts are coming to see that the adversary system doesn't particularly do much. If you look at the statistics for the prison industrial complex that you referred to, at some point it's going to have to be judged as any other industry, and it's a failing industry. The recidivism rate is exceedingly high. It never changes. It's always the same. It's because we have an alien institution at the end of the sentencing process.
Well, Hitler needed the Jews as a scapegoat. I think in some ways it's unfortunate. It's terribly unfortunate. But the Trumpsters and the others like him need criminals in order to convince people that they're going to provide them with safety.
Well, but, you know, the Trumpsters are not alone in that. I mean, you know, come on down to a codes committee meeting sometime down at our Capitol.
Sure.
In a liberal bastion bubble that we have all been in. And people make their electoral bones on trying to make expand crime, on trying to call my clients animals, on trying to dehumanize the other. That's how the justice system, the legal system, the electoral system, the legislative system has worked for as long as I have been a part of it. I actually think it is getting much worse than when I started, or else I was very naive when I started. Maybe it's been exactly the same, but I think there was a time when we actually had a government and it functioned in a way that you could bring about certain kinds of rational debate. But the idea of, you know, locking up sex offenders in prison beyond their date and having civil commitment and going after any crime, you know, a legislator goes home on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and while he was in Southampton, some EMT's radio was stolen from a car, and on Monday morning there's a D felony for stealing an EMT's radio from a car. I mean, it's a currency of politics. It's not a rational way to be. So I don't know that there's anything particularly different about Trump's use of poor people and black people and criminals. It's been the dog whistle that was present with George Wallace. It was the dog whistle that was present with Richard Nixon. It was the dog whistle that was present with George. You know, George Pataki reserved bill number one for the death penalty when he ran. Here's a guy running for governor with a very good chance of winning because of Mario's three terms. He runs. He doesn't say, I want to reserve chapter one because I want to be the governor known for curing spina bifida in New York. I want to make sure that AIDS is eliminated.
He was convinced.
I want to create the housing.
He won because of the death penalty.
He reserves the death penalty, right? Well, it was a complete and utter waste of time and money. $250, $300 million, not a single person executed. Everybody's time wasted that could have been better spent. There's been a lot of this going on for as long as I've been around.
Indeed you have, Jonathan Gratis. You are terrific. We've been in conversation with Jonathan Gratis, the executive director of the New York State Defenders Association, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving the quality and scope of public legal representation in New York. Jonathan, thanks so much for having been with us. It's a great pleasure getting back together with you.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you, Em.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.